If you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and lucky you if you do, the night of September 20th, tomorrow night, University Club of San Francisco is hosting the MIT Club of Northern California. And the discussion is How the Hippies Saved Physics. Dr. David Kaiser will be there. He's the author of the book, joined by Jack Sarfatti and Fred Allen Wolf, also by Dr. Russell Targ, one of the co-founders of Remote Viewing, the whole program that started at SRI, which is also profiled in this book. We're taking our break, and when we come back, we jump into the whole issue of entanglement, how to understand it, what it means, and how it helps us understand the world around us and the whole concept of reality. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. In the book, How the Hippies Saved Physics by David Kaiser, there's a description of a guy named John Bell who wrote about entanglement. Jack Sarfatti, help walk us through entanglement, spooky action at a distance, what it means, and maybe help us understand why it does not violate Einstein's speed limit.
Well, it
I know that's a lot to chew on there.
might. Actually, it might.
It might.
Now, there's something called passion at a distance, in which even though it's kind of a catch-22, and David explains it very well in his book, even though there is this fast-than-light influence, that you cannot use it to send a signal faster-than-light. So you sort of it's there, but it's useless. Most of modern quantum cryptography and quantum computer theory and quantum information theory uses that no signaling theorem as a almost as an axiom. But there's a David described how back in the 70s we were trying to Nick Herbert and myself and others were trying to break that signaling barrier with something called signal non-locality, and it looked for a long time. We accepted that it couldn't be done. I'm now having second thoughts again because of David's book, reawakening certain things, and I now think I may have a way of beating the no signaling, what also called the no cloning theorem. I could be wrong. I don't know yet, but it's I have a new angle on it. So. The phoenix is arising out of the ashes, and it may be possible to signal fast light. Now, let me explain something else. I'm involved in a government project. I'm involved in a joint project with the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency and NASA. And in fact, I'm giving a paper on all this on the weekend of September 30th, that weekend at the Orlando Hilton Hotel, in which I'll be discussing these things. And one of the reasons it's of practical importance is Jacques Vallée, you know, who's well known to UFO people.
Sure.
Vallée was at the first workshop of the DARPA-NASA joint project that I also attended. And Vallée pointed out how if we're going to reach the stars, we really need to be able to communicate faster than light. And if this entanglement, if the no signaling via entanglement barrier can be broken, of course, that would be very vital to our space effort. It's very important we re-examine all this, and even if it turns out it won't work, that's important to know also, especially since, as David pointed out, billions of dollars are being spent on all this, assuming you cannot signal faster than light, and we don't want it to turn out like that solar company where Obama gave them $500 million and the thing went bankrupt after a year. So, yeah, I mean, if it turns out that these billions of dollars are being invested in a technology that it actually is not as secure as people think, because of the intrinsic quantum randomness of individual quantum events, that's very important that we really know for sure that we cannot break the speed of light barrier. So I say the fat lady hasn't really sung yet on this. Probably we can't break it, but maybe we can. Okay.
Fred, sort of the same question for you. I know one of the issues that was considered by the physics group, the fundamental physics group, was whether or not entanglement could be used as some sort of for communication, or directly for communication. Maybe in that context, tell us whether you think it can or not.
Well, I don't think it can for a couple of reasons, and I'll try to make my idea clearer in terms of a metaphor. One of the things I try to do is spin metaphors to try to explain quantum ideas. You can think of entanglement as if you were watching two different television sets in different rooms. And on one television set, you see a fish head that grows and gets large, and then suddenly flips and becomes a tail. And in the other room, you're watching a fish swim from the right to the left and back and forth. And as far as you're concerned, let's say you decide to make a measurement of the fish head, and you stop the fish in a certain place as it's moving back and forth on your TV set. You have some kind of control. Well, at the instant you do that, the fish that's being watched in the other room suddenly starts moving in the given direction associated with how that would look to you in the first room. In other words, there would be some kind of effect that was connecting them, although you couldn't know for sure when you first tried to grab hold of the fish that was coming towards you that you would get it coming towards you. You might try to get it and it would flip and become a tail. But whatever it would do, the fish in the other room would do the same thing. So you would think, these two fish, they must be quantum entangled. What the truth is, there's only one fish.
Well,
now,
you know,
once you get that idea, you realize that sending a signal from yourself to yourself doesn't make any sense. And that's what quantum entanglement really is. It's a sense, it's telling us that what we think is as separation in space and time is really not that at all. And that's what I call the great trick of God. I mean, that's the great magic show in the sky, is that everything appears to be separated as separate objects, particles, whatever. But if we really were to see what's going on at the deepest level, which is maybe deeper than we've been able to perceive so far, although quantum field theory seems to be pointing in that direction, we may find out that there really is no such thing as separate objects. Jack mentioned Don Wheeler, who came up with an idea like that. He called Richard Feynman, his student, and says, "I know why there are positrons, or why there are." And he says, "Why?" Feynman asked him why. He said, "Well, there really aren't. He says, there's only one electron in the whole universe." "What do you mean?" "Well, it's going backwards and forwards in time." "And when it goes backwards in time, it looks like a positron going forward in time. And that's going on all over the place. So what we have are all these particles. There's really only one particle." And at first, that's the kind of conversation that David was referring to, that Feynman and Wheeler and many of Wheeler's students and had with him, because he was that kind of a guy. He wanted you to think about these kind of crazy ideas. And it's the craziness of the ideas which I think spurs great thinking. I don't think sitting down and calculating will do that. So, in fact, as an offshoot of this, the entanglement problem has led into cryptography. And David already mentioned that to you, that you can use a pair of entangled particles, two fish, so to speak, and you can let them interact with other particles. And by so doing, you can actually get information across without necessarily sending any information across, simply because you're making measurement on an entangled pair. So whatever you measure on one side of it will affect the measurement on another side of the universe, depending on how far apart they are.
And David, that part of it,
watching this, but that's about the best I could do in a short period of time.
Well, let me put it to David. It seems somehow counterintuitive what Fred just described there. And as you describe it in the book, you say, "I scratch a particle here on Earth and some particle on the other side of the universe is tickled." That seems counterintuitive. And yet, if you buy the theory, and as you mentioned, all the evidence seems to indicate that it's verified and it's true. If you buy it, there's an elegance to it, a beauty to it, that everything is connected, that goes beyond just physics and into philosophy and almost religion.
Well, it does. And you know, I think that's part of what drew me to the topic when I was a physics student, and certainly what drew me to this book to work on. I mean, the book, another way to think about the book is, who were the people who cared about this entanglement in the early days, before everyone knew it was sort of okay to do so, before it became textbook science? Who were the early adopters who saw this as important in its own right, and indeed as you say, it's sort of mysterious, but also has a certain beauty to it, certainly a charm. It's a great example of just how different the quantum world can be from our usual intuitions. And the credit for those early adopters goes back to the same group I keep mentioning, folks like Jack and Fred, with whom we're talking now, and Nick Herbert, and not a whole lot of other people in those early years. Some others, and some who weren't even in this Berkeley group, but they really had cornered the market. When you go back and look at the paper trail, look at who was working on it, who was citing whom, and so on. So I think the topic is one of those great, juicy ones that it's worth beating your head against for a long time. And indeed, remember, one member of this group, John Clauser, is the first person ever to have shown in a laboratory, not just on the scratch pad, that this very strange and counterintuitive notion, it really does make sense of experimental data far better than the kind of competing ideas seem to do. And then since then, others have gone, elaborations on that experiment to amazing detail. And so it's pretty hard to get around. It looks like entanglement is just a fact of the world. And then the question should be, well, what does that mean? What do we do with that? Where does it lead us next? And what might that imply about, reality as well as devices of a more immediate, practical concern?
I can see, Jack Sarfati, how extrapolating from entanglement would be a real threat to people's worldview, how scientists look at this.
I'd like to add, can I comment on what both Fred and... What Fred said is certainly true in terms of the rules of orthodox quantum theory. And what he said is accurate. And everybody, the mainstream believes exactly what Fred and also what David is saying, that entanglement is there, but you cannot use it as a standalone communication system. You can use it to encode information, but you also need a classical signal like a key to unlock that information that you non-locally encode. But however, as Feynman said, the most beautiful theory is murdered by an ugly fact. And both Fred and I were recently in June at the University of San Diego at a AAAS meeting in which a Cornell professor named Daryl Bem gave very good data, really peer-reviewed. And he's a top experimental psychology professor, kind of confirming the earlier work of Libet and Dean Radin and Dick Bierman, sort of backwards in time effects. Here's the thing. What quantum physicists say today is that if you have entanglement, you try to send a message locally, all you're going to see is random noise at the receiver. You can encode the message, but you're just going to see random noise at the receiver. But if you're actually seeing things, before they happen, which is shown in the data by Daryl Bem, which been then it's no longer random. You're actually seeing something. That's called signal non-locality. Now, it violates quantum theory. There's something else. There's a new physics happening, okay? And there's a guy named Anthony Valentini, a young physicist now at Clemson University, who has actually published papers showing how you have to change the rules a little bit of orthodox quantum theory to get these effects. And, we have the remote viewing work of Russell Togg and Harold Puthoff. In order to understand that kind of work and the work of Daryl Bem, we're going to have to change quantum mechanics in the same way that we change special relativity to get general relativity, that there's another control parameter, something that's being left out of the ordinary ideas of quantum mechanics. And this will be very profound because it's also going to affect the debate between Susskind and Hawking, although Hawking caved into Susskind and to Hooft about what happens when information goes through the event horizon of a black hole and this whole unitarity. There's a lot of deep stuff here, and this would be really revolutionary. But what I'm saying is that the experiments in psychology showing backward retrocausal effects in human consciousness and tying in with the claims of Puthoff and Targ and other people like that on the CIA experiments in remote viewing show that, basically what I'm saying is it looks as though it's empirically, and now I have a theoretical basis for it, that current-day orthodox quantum theory is not the final word. Now, a lot of people now, this is heretical. This is really heretical. And this is, in fact, I was disinvited from a conference because I was going to say this. And so was Brian Josephson, by the way.
I read those emails, Jack. Entertaining.
People are really threatened. And they actually, I understand, they should feel threatened because a lot of these people, if I turn out to be right, If I, and I may be wrong, I'm not saying I'm right, but if I turn out to be right, then a lot of very prominent physicists, theoretical physicists, are going to, will be proved wrong, which of course is not bad. That's the way science should be, but they feel threatened by it, you know, and especially since billions of dollars are being, it always comes down to money in the end, too, because as David said, billions of dollars are being spent assuming that these quantum computers and quantum information theory are going to really be secure because of the basic intrinsic randomness of the laws of nature, as David said before, but that may not be true. There may be a way out of that, okay, and I'm not saying there is. I could be wrong. I'm waiting for people to refute what I'm saying. I'm going to be giving a paper next week, you know, between the people at the Pentagon and NASA, and a lot of very powerful people are going to be there, and hopefully maybe it'll get refuted. So we're not, as John Paul Jones said, I've not yet begun to fight.
Okay. Well, you're going to have to update us on that. Let me ask this, David, maybe you can answer it. You deal with science in general terms and scientists and the mood of mainstream science. It seems to me that the real threat from this is that the paranormal becomes normal. Things like remote viewing and ESP, if entanglement can explain those, then what some consider the paranormal is really just normal, and we haven't understood it all that well, and that would seem to be threatening to a lot of folks' worldview.
Well, I think that's right. That's a large part of it. And, you know, I have a chapter in the book where I try to look at back in the day, back in the 70s and 80s, what were sort of mainstream or even illustrious Nobel laureate types? You know, what were they reacting to when interacting with people like Jack and Fred and Nick Herbert and some of the, or other folks who were active at the time? And one might assume, given the kind of proclivities, one might assume it was just shut them out, ignore it, and move on, and nothing could ever come of that. But in fact, I found a lot of examples of often very, I'd say actually very generous engagement. Those I'm sure were the exceptions and not the rule. But people like John Bell himself, who helped invent the notion of entanglement, writing a very charming letter to a parapsychology proponent, saying, I haven't seen it myself, but who am I to say? And there could be, in fact, much like Jack was just saying, there could be all kinds of hidden environmental effects we just haven't thought about yet. You know, it would have been very easy for someone like John Bell to say, forget it, it's obviously baloney, and leave me alone. And he took the opposite tack, and Eugene Wigner did that similar things, at least on occasions. And so you're right that it can touch a nerve, and certainly people then as now will, many of them I think will quickly, dismiss it and say that's just not, the question can't go there. That's not, the question's not allowed. But not everyone, and I think today, these days, there are best-selling books by, physicists like Michio Kaku.
David Deutsch.
And David Deutsch, certainly, that's right, who are tackling some of these things, not necessarily to endorse, but at least to say it's a question that makes sense with the tools that we know now, and again, just along the lines that Jack was saying a moment ago, with what we know now about quantum theory, go or no go, with reasonable extrapolations from quantum theory or general relativity or other ideas, could things change? And that's not, it's not that everyone's doing that, and that's not what every colloquium is about in physics departments, but I don't think it's quite the kind of ban or heretical line that I think it has been greeted with in the past. And so again, that's where I think there's a bit of an appreciation that questions can be worth asking, even if the answers might be surprising. And that, I think that in some senses, it hasn't always been that way, but I think you can see a bit more of that these days. And that's, I would say, a great good thing.
Fred mentioned a couple of minutes ago about how some of the students, the young people who first read of his stuff, are now in positions of authority and have moved up the scientific ladder and now are able to take this to a different level. And I guess that's how the whole process works, that there is change in scientific attitudes over time based on people dying out and moving on. And it's sad to say, but that's the reality. I want to take a break now. When we come back, I want to get into the a term coined by Fred, the universe, and the possibility that we can all create our own reality in some ways. Stay with us for Coast to Coast. We're talking with Fred Alan Wolf, Jack Sarfatti, and Dr. David Kaiser on Coast to Coast AM. David Kaiser, Fred Alan Wolf, Jack Sarfatti, my guests. We're talking about the nature of reality, entanglement, whether or not it's possible to sort of have a designer reality. I mean, is the universe here because we're here to see it? Can we affect it just with consciousness, our thoughts? Heady questions. We'll jump into those and sort of look at the future of science right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Fred Allen Wolf, I started the program tonight with sort of a reference to the old, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. In that context, is the universe here for our enjoyment, our benefit? Would it be here without us being around to perceive it? Fred?
I think one way of putting this is a few short lines from a poem that Richard Feynman once wrote. There are the rushing waves, mountains of molecules, each stupidly minding its own business, trillions apart, yet forming white surf in unison. Ages on ages before any eyes could see, year after year, thunderously pounding the shore as now. For whom? For what? On a dead planet with no life to entertain? Never at rest, tortured by energy, wasted prodigiously by the sun, poured into space? A mite makes the sea roar. And there we have the story. Because without us, we're those mites. We're the complications, the patterns of the repeating patterns of molecular structures which arose from those things, masses of atoms standing in the cradle on land, looking out, atoms with consciousness, matter with curiosity, standing and wondering, a universe of atoms, an atom in the universe. I think Feynman is capturing this whole picture we have, that somehow a universe without mind, a mindless universe, is really, in a sense, nothing. It doesn't really, in a sense, even exist. What we're looking at is that in order for us to understand a universe, we have to bring it into reality. It has to come into being. It isn't just a question of emptiness suddenly making something. It's a question of an intelligence, some form, some kind of thinking, some kind of rational mind at play that's constantly going on, even with all of the stuff that is constantly going on, even with all the bad and the good. We have this mind at play, a mind of God, so to speak, a field which is in the universe that comes into being along with everything else that comes into being. So I think what we're looking at here is, yes, the answer is yes. We need, the universe is there. It's our entertainment. It's also our creation. We're intimately involved with it. And to the extent that we can separate ourselves from it is, in a sense, encouraging, giving us an understanding, discouraging, and making us feel so alone. So we have this wonderful dyslexic reality in which we exist, this wonderful separation of mind from matter, which at the same time is an illusion that we continually go into in order to make sense of ourselves and the world.
Jack, I'm going to ask you sort of the same question, but in a slightly different way. You know, you get the feeling, sometimes I do, that we're all the star of our own movie. Maybe under this belief, this theory, we're also the screenwriter and the director of our own movie. And without us being there, there is no movie.
Well, okay, listen, I have a different take on all this. The big thing is retrocausality. I mean, that back from the future effects. And in modern cosmology, we are because of the dark energy, because of the fact that the universe is not only expanding, but it's speeding up. The universe is accelerating from this anti-repulsive gravitational dark energy field. Okay, it turns out that there is something called a horizon. It's kind of like the surface of a black hole, except we're inside it, rather than being outside a black hole. And it turns out there's one of David Kaiser's colleagues at MIT, is a guy named Seth Lloyd, who has published papers, even in Scientific American, that the horizon black hole is the ultimate laptop computer, that it's a computer, okay? And it's therefore,
since we have, since we're surrounded by this, what's called future event horizon, it's called the Sitter horizon, that's sort of made out of, that's an expression of the dark energy that's causing the universe to accelerate in its expansion. It's like a giant computer in the sky, which is what I think is Hawking's mind of God. It goes into kind of Teilhard de Chardin, the Catholic Jesuit's theologian, his what he called the Omega Point, kind of the mind of God that that Hawking was looking for. If you read the last few lines of his you know, his book about A Short History of Time, where he talks about this, what is the mind of God, even though Hawking himself has since published a book saying he doesn't think God is necessary. I think Hawking's wrong. I think Hawking has not even considered the implications of his own work, because a lot of this, what I'm talking about is based on Hawking's work, by the way, a paper he wrote, I think, with Gibbons, or it was with Ellis back in the 1970s, where he talks about cosmological horizons being very similar to black hole horizons, except we're inside them rather than outside them. But the thing is, in order for this whole scheme to work, it has to be coming back from the future, you see. And once we realize that, in other words, it's like destiny. That's why I wrote this book, Destiny Matrix, that there's the force of destiny coming back from the future, that there is this kind of super cosmic intelligence in the sky that we're kind of at the center of, in a sense, because of what are called observer-dependent horizons. So that's where we get back to your idea, George. You're saying that we each write our own script. Well, it's kind of observer-centered, so to speak, in a rough kind of way. And so, this is a picture I myself don't quite believe, but it's there. And it also ties into what's called the holographic picture of the universe, in which quantum fields, even the gravity field, the three-dimensional space are really effects of a boundary, of a surface. And in this case, the boundary surface is this future event horizon, which, according to Seth Lloyd, is a giant computer, and it may even be a conscious cosmic intelligence, you know, of what Philip K. Dick called VALIS, vast, active, living intelligence. And in a sense, we are kind of holographic images. You know, a man is in the image of God, literally, so to speak. But in any case, it's funny that the Catholics, you know, the Vatican, even though the Vatican astronomers are holding all these conferences, and they haven't a clue. They're totally clueless about what I'm talking about. Of course, if they understood what I'm talking about, the Pope would go absolutely bananas, because it's kind of a justification of the Catholic religion that I'm proposing here in a kind of half humorous but half serious way. So yeah, I have some very precise ideas about this, and you know, I'm playing with them.
Well, it sure makes us all feel even smaller than maybe we felt before. David Kaiser, I know you're the chronicler of this. You were not a member of the fundamental physics group, but let me get your take on it. Do you ever feel that reality isn't as real as maybe it used to be? That maybe we're someone's hologram, we're someone's dream, we're a star in a psychic sitcom?
You know, that's a good way of putting it. I might use that for a title of a paper, George. Will we come off?
Have at it. It's all yours.
You know, my own work in physics is in areas very much like what Jack was just describing. I also work in cosmology, and you know, it's a marvelous and I think very, very exciting field. We have lots of data now from very fancy experiments and satellites and all that, but it's also forcing people, even we might say kind of straight-laced people, to be thinking kind of on the surface crazy thoughts. I mean, it's just ridiculous if you just parse it in words until you go back and see the arguments for it and what leads to that line of thought. I mean, what if there are, you know, what if our entire universe is but, you know, a soap bubble in someone else's bathtub, which is more or less what a lot of string theorists are suggesting now with the notion of a multiverse, something that I think both Fred and Jack have written about it over the years. Fred wrote a whole book about parallel universes some time ago. And this notion of a multiverse is sort of all the rage now. And it's not just all the rage in, you know, Cafe Trieste, North Beach, San Francisco. It is there, I'm sure. But also, you know, just as much so in the seminar halls at MIT and sort of everywhere in between. And so I think cosmologists as a whole are one group, not the only one, but one group who are forced to start wonder about what could it mean to have a world here, a universe here at all, and what's beyond the horizon, as Jack is saying, and how could we ever make sense of it if we are going to be stuck, you know, within one of these bubbles? How do we follow our thoughts to really the furthest unknown, where we have, you know, an infinite sea of universes with 10 to the 1,000 different types of universe, each of them realized an infinite number of times? I mean, you know, That's pretty fun stuff, but it's it gets us pretty far afield from that kind of shut up and calculate mode.
I'd like to ask each of you at least to each reflect on at least one more question, and then it deals with the science and politics. I guess science has always been political to some degree or another, but now it's sort of in the last couple of months, last couple of years, it's spilled over into the political arena where scientific topics, or rather maybe an anti-scientific strain has popped up repeatedly. I don't want to get into all the specifics and set off everybody's hot buttons, but you know where I'm heading with this, is that there is an anti-science sentiment. It seems to be, if not growing, at least strong. And I wonder if you each worry about where it's heading. Fred, let's start with you.
Well, I there's always been anti-scientists.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all over the place. I'm not sure which one you're speaking about here, there have always been groups that have felt this way. I don't think we're headed in that direction at all. In fact, what I see happening is that there is a growing interest in understanding where we are in the universe. There's more at play here. I mean, it certainly is. We're going into situations where, economically speaking, we may be finding ourselves with less rather than more. We're going to be looking for new solutions to our problems, our energy problems, for example. We're going to have to start thinking like that. I think that science is not going to become less in the mind of people, but it's going to even be more. It's going to take even a stronger hold. But I think it won't take such a strong hold as long as scientists become pedantic, as long as they hold on to their ideas and restrict them in such a way that only the highfalutin can know what they're talking about. There's got to be some effort to bring the average person into the stream, so to speak, so that science becomes a popular and well-understood subject.
Jack, same question. As you know, I mean, this is heady stuff. It's sometimes hard to get your head around if you're not a trained scientist, if you don't have a degree in this sort of thing. And it sometimes seems like the gap between regular people and the high priests of science widens rather than narrows. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I agree with what, with what Fred just said, basically. But I think what you're referring to is a controversy maybe over global warming. Is it man-made? Is it sunspots? And that's a very complex issue. And I myself, you know, it's not my field. I don't have a position on it. I'm open to both sides of the argument. I know there are some very eminent physicists now who are saying that it's not man-made, or that it's just, you know, some maybe solar or other things. And it's a complicated thing, and I think there has to be civil discourse on both sides, people listening to each other about it. And then I suppose you're also talking about the anti-abortionists.
Evolution.
Choice. Yeah, evolution. And I think, by the way, I think I have a way of reconciling both sides of this thing. It has to do with what I was saying before, but that would be topic maybe for another show, how both sides have something to say, that they're both right and they're both wrong. Because what the, you know, if you only think that cause and effect goes from past to present to future, if you only think the causation goes in one direction,
linear,
then
right,
there's a problem. But once you have kind of final cause teleology, where it's going in both directions, like sort of the way Yahya Aharonov, who just got a medal from Obama about his theory where time goes in both directions. In fact, Fred Wolf wrote a book about it years ago called Star Wave. Once you include those concepts, in addition with this other thing, signal non-locality, which is like the next step beyond orthodox quantum theory, sort of the way general relativity went beyond special relativity, it's an extension of quantum theory. Well, with all those things, then you can reconcile these things. And I don't know if you're also referring to, of course, you know, the anti-scientific attitude of the Islamofascists, you know, who want to take us back to the seventh century, and you know, put the women, you know, circumcised women, and put them in burqas and totally enslave them, things like that. yeah, that's a real danger. I agree.
Absolutely. Yep. David Kaiser, same sort of question. I ask it in this context. Are you optimistic about the future? I mean, the Earth facing some major challenges and major threats. Are you optimistic that science will come to the rescue?
Well, I'd say I'm cautiously optimistic. I am. Yeah, I still see the glasses, I guess, slightly more than half full. Is that fair to say? And I recognize the sort of controversies you've been referring to and that Jack and Fred just spoke to quite well. And these are, you know, these are genuine hard issues. I think the science involved in many, not all, but in many of these cases is complicated. That doesn't make it easier to get all sides to agree, because there's lots of moving parts in these arguments. And we can all take our sides, but I think it's right that these are complicated issues that they're going to require, just as Jack just said, a kind of patience and also a kind of civility. I'm cautiously hopeful that will begin to be the mode. You know, one of the things that drives the story in my book is the kind of ebb and flow of funding, and also how enrollments can track with that. You know, when is it a boom time for physics and lots of kids get excited and go into physics, and when is it lean times? And this past June, MIT graduated more undergraduate physics majors than we have in about 35 or 40 years. So if we take numbers like that as an indication, then I wouldn't count us out yet. I mean, there's a lot of young people who are still really excited about science, getting trained, you know, very, very carefully, working very hard on their homework and their problem sets, going to grad school. And so I'd say the numbers are there. We'll have our budget battles, and that'll be, you know, fraught, but I don't think anyone's going to wipe off science from the country or from the face of the earth. And so therefore, in the longer term, I do see reasons for some confidence.
Fred, you coined the term universe, Y-O-U, universe. Have you made your own? I mean, is that a reality for you?
Whether I like it or not, I continually do it. We all do. Unfortunately and fortunately, we suffer and we enjoy the makings of our own worlds that we live in. Fortunately, they overlap enough so that we can appreciate each other's creations. And we just walk through life that way. Most of us are unbeknownst that we're doing it, and we think we're somehow victims of what other people are doing, but actually nobody really is. And waking up to that fact, realizing that people have more power than they ever thought they did, is part of my motivational shtick, so to speak, my vaudevillian act, so to speak, is to just say, wake up, everybody. There's more power to being alive than just following what other people are telling you.
You're like Norman Vincent Peale to the 10th power or something.
Maybe. Maybe there's a rabbi inside of me aching to get out. I don't know. Maybe I've got past lives that are filtering through me. I have no idea. But I'm having fun doing what I do, and I love the idea of bringing quantum physics and consciousness, mind of God, and spirituality, and motivational encouragement to people. I think we need encouragement right now. Depression and feeling sorry for oneself is pretty much part of our mainstream and a large part of our American life. And I think we do need to keep motivating each other.
Fred and Jack, there's a reference in David's book about a film that was made on a beach somewhere with you guys in costumes. I'd love to see that sometime if you want to put it online.
I think it's on my Facebook video. I think parts of it. But Fred, we have to put up a better version on YouTube. I think it may be on YouTube, but somewhere. Parts of it are up there, but it's not done. It has to be edited.
I do have it. It's a movie that I directed at Black's Nudist Beach, starring Jack Sarfati as God. I mean, that's an actual role for him to play.
I want to thank both of you for
it. I wrote it and put it together, and there's a soundtrack to it, which is of all the hippy dippy songs from the 70s, including The Doors, by the way, and many other songs. It's a fun kind of a thing. If you'd like to see it, send me an address and I'll send you a disc.
Okay.
That's probably the best way to watch it. I might be able to upload it, but it's a big file. It's about a 20-minute movie.
I want to get one more comment from David about the book. The reaction generally from the reviewers has been great. Are you taking any heat, though, to speak of?
Oh, a modest amount. You know, in some sense, I try to tell myself it's a good thing. People are reading it. If they're getting, getting excited about it, excitement can come in, at least one of two signs. And a lot of it has been positive, and a small minority so far at least has been negative. But, you know, if it weren't worth their getting upset about, then it wouldn't have been worth writing. So, that's how I have to go with this.
David Kaiser, thanks very much. The book is called How the Hippies Saved Physics. Fred Allen Wolf, Jack Sarfati, a great conversation. Thank you all very much for being here. And the three of you will be appearing September 20th in San Francisco at the University Club of San Francisco, if anybody lives in that area. Sue Switek coming up next. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM.